Thanks for joining us for this Views and Brews podcast, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. We hope you enjoy the show.
We're getting started tonight with a show that was inspired by Charles Mingus and an article I sent you on Tijuana Moods, of which we'll be hearing no tunes from that record. However, it is a fantastic record, and it is on the promo, and so I encourage you to go out and listen to it. But why do we want to do this evening? And I'll have to introduce you, I guess, too. Rabbi and jazz historian Neil Blumhoff, welcome.
Good evening, everybody. We had a nice conversation about this evening and what it could be shaped to be. And, you know, this we're living, I think, as we have for a long time, in a fraught moment. And this idea of contending with loneliness and purpose and driftlessness, this idea of trying to find where we belong, with whom we belong, this idea of home or homelessness, this idea of who is and constructs a culture and a society. These are all the different ideas that I think brought us to the point where we were going to name it Jazz and the Art of Migration. But I think the art of movement, I think, gets a little bit more deeply to what we're trying to do. Those who choose to where they're going, those who have no choice in where they're going. And I think that kind of conversation is one that I think we can discuss. And I think one that jazz is the incredible art form of America can really anticipate and help us think in new ways about things. We say all of this as the Amazon is burning. There was a photograph posted from space today, that you could see the Amazon burning from space. And this idea of belonging and the experiences, certainly as a Jewish person from Europe, where people recognize that even fighting in the army, being honored for fighting in the army in World War I, people felt that they didn't belong, that they're an infestation. These are languages and words that have been used in history, and it's very unfortunate to have to think about it and navigate all of that now in the contexts in which we're living. And I think that kind of dread that we carry, I think we can address and think about how this music, and I've thought a lot about this particular program. I think about all of them for days. I've been thinking about this one, and I wanted to highlight sort of how the music can help us think about things and how music can actually reclaim these things. For example, one of the things that when we get to a Nina Simone tune, there is a wedding song, if you look at some of the Jewish wedding liturgical music from the 19th century.
As we're just, all want to me. Do.
I don't know, your hands are probably all up. I can't see. But one, I don't know. I it's all the people in the back. So there's a tune that is used that is very much a part of the 19th century German Jewish wedding tune that kind of went out of favor in the 20th century because it became the song, it's a folk tune, that became the song of Deutschland über alles, which is the anthem of the Nazis. But you can see it in the music, and it was a very dear, honored, revered song before it became that. So how music can both claim and be charged with associations that are both positive and obviously very negative. So I wanted to pick some of that music too.
Shall we go to the music?
Or we can just sit here? Are you guys doing
just
well?
Just sit here and hang
Everybody's
out.
Comfortable? Okay, so how are you?
I'm wonderful. I think this idea of, you know, the music is encoded with certain things, as Stuart Hall would say, the cultural theorist we did a documentary on a couple years ago. But he would say that the music is encoded with something and then decoded differently from generation after generation. And I think, like, thinking about this idea of how music or just our conversations are encoded in one space and then decoded in another time and in another space. And maybe starting out with that idea, thinking about that idea with the first couple tunes we're going to hear
might be interesting. Well, it helps us move and think about things more creatively. I would like to set the tone for the tunes to ask us to think about what America stands for and what we are. And there's, of course, the poem that we created in, or we said in liner notes that we airs weekly on Sundays.
Sunday morning jazz.
Right. So
Jay Trachtenberg.
There was a contest back in the 1880s to raise money for the Statue of Liberty engraving, and there was a young woman named Emma Lazarus who submitted a particular poem that became engraved or actually plated on the statue. And if maybe you've had a chance to see it, but I would like us to start with that, if that's all right. This is called The New Colossus. Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame, with conquering limbs astride from land to land, here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch, whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name Mother of Exiles. From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome. Her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that twin cities frame. Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp, cries she with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. And it is with that understanding, and we can go into a whole history of that, which I'd rather not at this point, but I think it's really interesting. Emma Lazarus, who worked indefatigably about refugees trying to escape from, Jews trying to escape from Tsarist Russia in the late 19th century. She died in 1887, I believe. And this was engraved in the statue, I think in 1907. And but I think it's really something for us to recover our past as we encounter our present. So I'd like us to start with a tune that you all know. And it's a tune that I think can be revived based on what we were saying with our own meaning. And we'd love to invite the band to come forward. This is a tune, I think we're going to do two, okay? The first one is America the Beautiful. And we're going to sort of offer it in a way that I think is just an important aspect of both resistance and noticing and presence. And then we're going to offer a particular tune, In the Evening by the Moonlight, which is a tune by Nina Simone, or that she recovered, actually. She recovered it from a guy named James Bland, who was an African-American, who wrote a particular song with lyrics that negatively portrayed African-Americans in a way that was a commercial success. James Bland was billed as the greatest minstrel man. And if you'll forgive me, he was called the Prince of Negro Songwriters, which is complicated. But he also broke down the barrier to white music publishers because he was popular. So this layering, In the Evening by the Moonlight, Nina Simone wrote her own lyrics that were to reclaim this tune and how to be able to read a story or hear a piece of music in a variety of ways. So if you perhaps heard James Bland's music writing in 1880, it would sound like a very stereotypical negative portrayal. And after Nina Simone, we'd like to sort of offer it in a different way. So America the Beautiful and In the Evening by the Moonlight. And it's our pleasure to welcome our extraordinary band, celebrating 25 years at the University of Texas. What? So John Fremgen on bass, everybody.
You get a pin for that.
Good to have our friend Scott Lanningham back on drums. Celebrating a lot of children. I don't know if it's 25, but there's a bunch. Yeah. Red Young, man, it's just the gift that keeps on giving on piano. And our wonderful front section, we've got Michael Malone on saxophone. Andre Hayward on trombone. And our friend Adrian Ruiz on trumpet. Ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
faithful. For heroes prove in liberating strife, who more than self their country love, and mercy with this next part, please. Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grace. Oh, for purple mountain majesties above. a little fun. Then my daddy used to take his fiddle down that hung upon the wall, while the silvery moon was shining clear and bright. As we used to sing in the evening by the moonlight. In the evening by the moonlight, you could hear banjos ringing. You could hear them by the moonlight. You could hear my folks all singing. Oh, my mother. evening by the moonlight. Hey!
So just as we think about things, America the Beautiful, by the way, was composed on a train trip by a woman who lived on the East Coast who went out to teach for a semester in Colorado. And as she was going out on the train, she was inspired by what she saw. And the poem was originally called Pike's Peak. And the music was written by some other guy who was on a ferry from Coney Island in New York. And, you know, I wanted to, I'll come up there. I wanted us to think about the fervor of people, immigrants to this country, like Irving Berlin, who wrote God Bless America, and also the connection of, say, 50 years ago, y'all remember Jimi Hendrix playing at Woodstock, the Star-Spangled Banner. So we wanted to do the America the Beautiful in the style of Ray Charles as he sang it in 1976 for the bicentennial of this country. So... I thought that was interesting.
It was very good. Rabbi Neil Blumhoff.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
You know.
So you hadn't heard that In the Evening by the Moonlight before. I think.
I had never heard that before.
Yeah, it's a good tune, again, to sort of reclaim things that perhaps are so tender and so hard to hear, which is our American landscape. And I think I'd like, as we get into things, I'd like to talk about when is that kind of resistance, persistence appropriate? When does something just become appropriation?
Should you switch my, yeah, we'll do it. So, you know, costume change. As you switch microphones there, I think that one of the lines from...
Should I sing again? Did you guys hear the singing? Yes.
You okay. Should just sing, just for fun. Let's do it again. Whole thing. Where's the poem? Oh, I don't know
the
where
poem?
It is.
You
but anyway, you know, this idea of holding a lamp to the door, coming in out of the darkness, like that image, I think, I was thinking about that a lot after we recorded the liner notes, and this last line, I lift my lamp beside the golden door.
Well, you either think so or you don't. I mean, really, I mean, what,
well, it's
either,
also,
either
what
you
is
buy
the,
it or you
what
don't.
What is the golden door? You know, like,
obviously,
what does that
Brooklyn.
Lead to? Obviously.
Obviously, Brooklyn.
But, you know... I mean, I feel as if, you know, what this represents or what this says to us is that that myth is also very, very important, you know, and I think no matter what administration has come before our current administration, there's always been kind of an upholding of a myth of what the United States is, what we represent, who we are, how we function, what we do and what we don't do, and what opportunities we have to ride the white horse.
Although, to be fair, there have been very nativist traditions in the past. I mean, there's a whole understanding of the Johnson Reed Act, which was passed in 1924, which is called the Immigration Act, the Asian Exclusion Act, the National Origins Act, which is all prejudice and fear-based, which prevented millions of people from escaping from Europe, my people also, at the most difficult time. And that can't, it's not a new thing. And, you know, Robert Taft in the middle of the 20th century. I mean, all of this stuff about, well, what does it mean? I mean, who is this golden door for? Is it for the people on one side of the door or the other side of the door? And who gets to decide that? And who gets to decide who comes in?
Mm-hmm. And what do we hold on to that uphold the myths that we live by?
I think that's a good question. And I think as Nina Simone sort of heard this song, which is, again, a horrible lyrics, a minstrel lyrics, you could say, well, I'm not even going to talk about that aspect of history, or I'm going to dive into it, have the difficult conversations about it, and try to redeem that which needs to be redeemed. So I think as a country, so last week I was up in, I did a witness trip with a good friend of mine, a wonderful leader here in Austin, Reverend Daryl Horton, Mount Zion Baptist Church, and last year we went to points in the South. We went to Houston, to the Holocaust Museum in New Orleans, Selma, Montgomery, Birmingham, Memphis, and Little Rock, and we posted about it. And this year, I wanted to show that that's not limited, that hatred, that difficulty is not limited only into the South. So we went to New York, not because Delhi, but because there's like stuff going on in New York.
We did go to the deli, though. I watched the videos.
We went to the deli.
And you can find the videos at Rev... And Rav.
Yeah. Okay, Rev Rav. But
not, dot, yeah,
Rev Rav Summer Witness 2019.
Yeah, okay. On Facebook.
Yeah. So we went to Wall Street. That's interesting. But, you know, Wall Street was actually the place where the slave market in New York was that you don't see or you don't know or we're not taught about. There were places of uprising. There were places of execution. There were in Foley Square, which is right by all the court systems. So these are important places to know about. We went to Harlem that has a storied, beautiful history. We went to Crown Heights, which has a sense of fraught relationship between African Americans and Jewish people, where it used to originally be a place, only one of three places in New York, where free blacks could live. Before and after the Civil War. And that is history that nobody knows. So I think it's important to dive into it versus just seeing what's on YouTube and you're just kind of taking it as sort of for granted. We need to know things and we need to be uncomfortable about it.
Well, there's also an interesting moment in the videos that you shared from your trip where here's the Golden Door, right? Here's a poem that is on the Statue of Liberty. It's one entrance point. Mm-hmm. And then you traveled to another entrance point. Talk a little bit about that.
Right. So my people, anybody? Ellis Island. So Ellis Island was a big entry point right near the Statue of Liberty. We make a left. It's right there. But there's a place. Do you all know about Pier 17? Yes. South Street Seaport, anybody? Pier 17. There's no signage. There's a new Chipotle, though. But Pier 17 is where people came who were enslaved in this country, and that was the point of entry for many, many, many thousands of people that we don't hear about, that history has lost. When we were in Boston, we went to Long Wharf. Nobody? Great. There's a new Chipotle at Long Wharf. But that's the place where people were bought and sold and shipped all over the Caribbean, while the people in Boston were able to profit on sugar and other things, endowing places like Harvard University Law School, for example. So these are very, once you start connecting those dots, there's a place that still remains in Boston, in Medford, actually. It's called the Royal, R-O-Y-A-L-L, the Royal House. And it's the last remaining place where slaves lived. It's in Boston, everybody. The place of abolitionism, right? But Isaac Royal and his family were some of those who created an amazing economic boom in Boston, but we need to know where that comes from and on whose backs that happened. And it's just like Faulkner said, the past is never past. Just, it's always present. But there's no signage at Long Wharf. There's no signage at Pier 17. And while we were gone, I don't know if y'all saw the articles in the New York Times called 1619. That's the beginning of the conversation. But others would say that it actually, our history of our country actually started long before that, which we'll hopefully get to in just a minute.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I do want to touch upon, though, this thing that you mentioned, alluded to, which is there's a new Chipotle. You know, there's a new Chipotle, there's a new Chase Bank, there's a new whatever, which is the way in that the struggle within the United States, within a capitalist society, is one that is really interesting, you know? Because in one hand, I just heard this beautiful conversation with Ilya Kaminsky, who's a Ukrainian poet. I won't say too much about it, I know. And Rachel Zucker on a poetry podcast called Commonplace. But they were talking about, oh, here we go, that's what you say. But they were talking about this really interesting thing, which is like you can kind of get lost in translation, like lost in translated poets and poems and literature, and forget what the struggle is of your time period right now. And I think it's a very interesting conversation to have when we are trying to find a voice or a space of resistance or imagined resistance within a capitalist society, instead of, or perhaps and, also making space and finding a voice for past struggles that need to be recognized outside of the marketplace. So there's a way for struggles to be identified and commodified within a marketplace. But how do you share and understand what is happening right now and what you're dealing with and what we are all dealing with? I mean, Johnson & Johnson has to pay, what, $538 million, you know, for the opioid crisis. That's a real crisis in the United States. These are things that we're coming in contact with. A lot of us are touched by every single day. But it may be easier for us to talk about the struggles of the past.
Well, it's hard work, but I think that people can take a page out of Montgomery, Alabama. Anybody? Nobody? And the Equal Justice Initiative run by Brian Stevenson, who has very deliberately began to post signage and began to have with the Legacy Museum from slavery to mass incarceration, which opened last year, the Lynching Memorial, which opened last year, just plainly say, this is also part of our country, this is part of our country, and rather than try to solve things or make peace with things or reparate things, which is hard and controversial, let's just say what is. This has also happened, and nobody's going to deny that that happened. So have that be, if we're able to think about it and process it and metabolize what the fuller picture of things are, I think we can both have our Chipotle and eat it too. You know?
Well then.
You know? You know, really.
I have nowhere to go.
I think
from
we're, because it's not either or. You know what I'm saying? It's not like, well, I'm going to give up, you know, the consumerist society. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's impossible.
So what I'm saying is have the conversation. And if you watch the videos, we go from subway shop to subway shop. So, but you watch, you know, allow yourself to feel that, as you called it, dissonance or discomfort while we're enjoying what we have, because it is both and. It is not either or. And we have to do it together, and we have to do it together, because if we don't do it together, it will become too sharp and too painful. We have to discover a new language. We have to search for a new land together that way.
I think that idea of together is a really interesting thing. Yeah. So what are we going to hear next?
Well, we're going to hear a little bit about appropriation. So we heard this idea of America the Beautiful done in a really beautiful way. By Ray Charles, this idea of, you know, maybe passion or bringing one's own experiences to the essentiality of a country. We heard what Nina Simone did with In the Evening by the Moonlight, sort of redeeming a song. We're going to hear three songs now. The first one was written by Coleman Hawkins, wonderful saxophone player. You guys doing okay? Come on, y'all. That second tune was meant to loosen y'all up a little bit. Good. I don't know if it worked, but... But this is called Disorder at the Border. Coleman Hawkins recorded it live at Birdland in 1952. It wasn't released until 1973. Disorder at the Border. Maybe a touchy subject for folks in the 60s, 50s.
Anybody here for our Coleman Hawkins show? We did a show at Coleman Hawkins.
We did on Coleman Hawkins, right? Then we're going to hear another song that you might know. It's called South of the Border, Down Mexico Way, featuring Adrian Ruiz, right? It's a 1939 tune that was written for the Gene Autry film, Down Mexico Way. It's considered to be one of the top 100 Western songs of all time. But in singing a song like this, what do we see and who do we disgrace, right? Just there were early songs like Irving Berlin who wrote songs about racist stereotypes, about Jews, Germans, not he didn't do this all, but other composers, Jews, Germans, Chinese, Dutch, Irish, and of course Native Americans. And what I'd like us to think about, what kind of relationship do we have with our neighbors from generation to generation? And how do we see each other, and in what ways do we reduce each other? Because the song ends with us all singing, I. You were all going to do it, and it's going to feel horrible. And then the last song is going to be of the set is going to be Cherokee, which was written by Ray Noble in 1938, also called the Indian Love Song, y'all. So once we start having that conversation about 1619, buckle up, because there's a chapter before that as well, okay? Cherokee was intended as the first of five movements for an Indian suite called Cherokee, Comanche War Dance, Iroquois, Seminole, and Sioux, Sioux, okay? And this was influenced, somebody named Buddy DeFranco is a jazz musician who wrote a piece called Swing the Indian. So, oh yeah, be proud of it.
Is this the same Cherokee that Clifford Brown?
Yeah. It's Coco and Charlie Parker did. So the three tunes, y'all, Disorder at the Border, which is a blues number, which I think you'll enjoy. And then we'll just be exquisitely uncomfortable with South of the Border, Down Mexico Way, and Cherokee, and redeem them in our own way, if we can. Y'all up for that? So let's welcome our musicians back, everybody. These three tunes. Thank you.
maestro or whatever.
Whatever. Whatever. I like whatever. Three.
Thank you.
Scott Lanningham on drums. Hang out for a second, guys. Hang out for a second. Hang out, hang out. John Fremgen on bass. Have a seat, Scott. It's nice. Not only an Austin legend, what can I say? Just an amazing man who's changed music all over this world. Red Young, everybody. What a gift it is, man. It really is. No, seriously. Adrian Ruiz, everybody, checking it out. Andre Hayward, it's nice to have you, sir. On the saxophone is Michael Malone. So we want to ask you, you know, you may or may not know this, but I'm Jewish. And you know, this was a really hard but very wonderful way of sort of thinking through deeply some of these songs and really thinking twice, three or four times about it. And, you know, as we, again, America the Beautiful is really imagining the wilderness or imagining this as the composer would the poet, which I'm going to certainly let you know who she is, which is going to be great. Catherine Lee Bates. As she makes her way forward, you know, this is the wilderness in the 1880s. And I'm reading this book, I'm finishing this book, which is just a really one of the more painful books I've ever read. It's called The Earth is Weeping by Peter Cozens. And it's a military history of the Indian Wars from the 1860s and the 1890s. So I'm just imagining the fruited plains and this amazing mountains majesty that this land is weeping. And as we talk about things, the movements, whether in the 19th century or the 20th century after World War I and the great migration from the south to the north by African Americans, there's a Jewish concept that states that, we're gonna do a little Bible for a second, but you know, in the beginning, you remember that? It's the first part. And there's an understanding that the world is actually built on chaos and void. In Hebrew, it's tohu vavohu, that the world is actually built on what some in the Middle Ages would call a garbage heap, that our most beautiful beauty, our most amazing wonder and splendor, and, you know, as we all have to shuck and jive and represent, whether it's black face or Jewish face or Indian face or Tejano face, we would love to hear Adrian and all of us, how's it playing this music? Like, what is this about? It's like, for me, like an endless Hava Nagila, you know? Like, what? Like, oh, really? Again? Like, what? This is like the most stereotypical, the exoticized, the fetishized, the othering, like the complete, like, that's what we thought you were supposed to be. Adrian, we'd love to hear, and others to weigh in a little bit, if you want to. Like, what is it like playing south of the border, right? Or playing Cherokee, and it's funny, but we're trying to raise a bigger point.
Well, that's an interesting question. I was born and raised in San Antonio, Texas, so this was deeply embedded in my upbringing. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, this south of the border thing, I know we were kind of talking about getting everything together earlier, but, and then I'd mentioned, oh, man, all right, you're going to bring the south side out in me, you know. So maybe it might sound stereotypical, but there is a sense of pride in a way, you know, to be able to connect with that type of music. I mean, ever since I can remember, I mean, the first music that I ever heard on the radio was AM radio, KEDA, Radio Jalapeno, Jalapeno Radio, you know, and I mean, but seriously, I mean, fortunately, I've had an opportunity to study with some really, really great professors, and I've reached the pinnacle and have been fortunate to get a doctorate of musical arts, and it's my former professor back here. But seriously, John Fremgen. But seriously, believe it or not, I mean, as I. But there is that sense of pride, because out of all seriousness, I didn't hear my first English tune on FM radio until I was 11 years old. And yeah, I mean, I'm telling you, 1978 Ford Fairmont, you know, that was the first new vehicle that my family bought. And it was 91.7 FM in KITY. Santa Maria, you're my everything. That's the first English tune I ever heard. But yeah, just kind of bringing it back around, it's like there's a sense of pride, you know, to be able to play something like that.
Because it was made popular by Frank Sinatra, and it was certainly not, it was written for the marketplace, right? Anybody else want to weigh in about any of the songs, like the Nina Simone song? Michael, you want to say something? You got nothing? No? We're all having fun. Anybody read? Nothing? John?
The only thing I would say is that we just try to serve the music. And so whether it's something campy like South of the Border or something that we've never done, like the Nina Simone tune, we're just trying to not be caricatures and play it seriously. You know, no one on this stage is a caricature. So, you know, it's even when we're kind of goofing around on South of the Border, we're still pretty playing some pretty serious stuff. I don't know if you noticed, but I'm like, what is he doing over there? That wasn't on the Sinatra version. But it's not... it's not campy, you know. So yeah, you know, I think our job as serious musicians is to take anything like this and serve it, you know, and present it to you guys in a way that doesn't sound trivialized. So that's my token.
Thanks. So I appreciate that. And again, I think we're going to do one more music or talking thing, and then we'll come back in the music. So again, give it up for our musicians, everybody. Be back to it. You know, I do think, though, I really appreciate as artists serving the music. I do think, though, that the music is political in its nature. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. And this understanding of the backlash of imagining cultures, the backlash of generous borders or of people passing back and forth. So I think at least the last couple of tunes are going to be, hey, Michael, the last couple of tunes are going to be sort of reflecting the sense of backlash of America. You guys lived through America, love it or leave it? Better red than dead? Hello? Okay. So the idea that I think that, you know, it's nice to sort of, you know, say that here we are, you know, we're sort of redeeming sparks from what is, but there's a whole, you know, understanding that, you know, we have gone as far as we can and no farther. So I think that it's an interesting juxtaposition between sort of this music that highlights a sense of exoticism and also that which says, yeah, stop. Just we're going to put this in a place so we can see it, name it, and leave it in a distance.
And really quick before we start again, just one more round of applause for our incredible musicians. We are so lucky here in Austin. Like sometimes, honestly, I have to pinch myself because I'm like, these are incredible people who are so talented and they bring you wonderful experiences, and please go and see them as they play out in Austin.
Support live music, y'all. Before you get into your
reverie. I know. I'm just getting my poem out because I don't have my notes. But that's
how many of you grew up playing cowboys and Indians? Or cops and robbers? You know, this idea of this, you know, sort of puts us in a particular place, and I know you're gonna read something amazing. But I just wanted to, I was in Jerusalem this summer. Nobody? Okay, Jerusalem, whatever. Jerusalem. All right, God bless Austin.
The most beautiful weather at 3 p.m. every day, no matter what.
So we were talking about nationalism and the understandings of nationalism, and we really came across this understanding that is a sort of a new field in Jewish studies, but it's based on African American studies. And I just want to raise it here. I'm the guy who depresses everybody today. I'm sorry.
Wah, wah.
But there's a field of study in African American studies called Afro-pessimism. And with it now, there's a theme called Judeo-pessimism, which Afro-pessimism teaches that there's a construct of blackness which is different than a hierarchy or different than a system and systemic economics like that, that was invented to serve essentially of majority. But the construct of blackness is that blackness in itself is slaveness. And there's no redemption story to this. It's just what is, that it's irreversible and it's irredeemable. That blackness is going to be always there no matter what happens. And being Jewish just is going to be what it is. And the best scenario is not some sort of redemption, but the best scenario is to obtain a begrudging a begrudging tolerance. So to go back to this New Colossus, which was written to reclaim the seventh wonder of the world, of the ancient world, to America, to the new shores, to understand that embedded in our DNA, let alone our society, is this understanding that we can't escape others' perceptions of who we are, no matter what we try to do. So I think that is just, I know, I'm sorry. We're going to, the art of joy next time, y'all. So sorry. But I've been thinking about this, and I know y'all have been thinking about this a lot, and I think that these deeper conversations are important, and that's just what's on my mind. So the backlash of this and people who, you know, no matter what we try to do, you know, it's just not going to accept. I think but I want us to analyze and think about what are the costs of living in a fear-based environment. What are the costs of living in a fear-based environment without choosing joy as we navigate our identity and our well-being and to cultivate honest relationships together?
Well, I was going to read a poem, but I won't now, because I honestly think like that is a really interesting concept. I mean, this like Terry Eagleton, who's a theorist, writes that the study of ideology is a study in how we become complicit in our own unhappiness. And that, you know, part of being an effective oppressor is to make you identify with power. And that the only way to find political emancipation or any type of emancipation is to really free ourselves from ourselves, you know, to get out of these constructs that we find ourselves in and to realize that. Has anyone ever seen a grasshopper in a jar? Like, have you studied this at all? The way that...
What do you do all day?
I know. I work for public radio. I have tons of time on my hands. So basically... So if you ever look at a grasshopper, right? You put a grasshopper in a jar and you put a lid on it and it will jump and it'll hit the lid and it'll be like, I hate my life, whatever. And then it'll come down. Anyway, you take the lid off the jar, and the grasshopper only jumps as high as the previous lid would allow it to jump. So it won't jump out of the jar. It'll just jump, and then it'll think, like, I used to get hit here. I'm not going to jump any higher. But, you know, I mean, I feel as if, like, in a lot of ways, what is this idea? What is freeing ourselves from ourselves? What is saying we don't have to be within this construct and we can get out of it? And what is freedom within that space?
Well, I think there's a lot of, one can liberate oneself if one realizes that in essence, you can't please somebody else and you can just come to terms with who you are and what you are. And I think there's a healing power in that. So whether you're going to get out of the jar or not, and I think that, you know, once you can become your essential grasshopper-ness, then I think that there's a real sense of way forward.
You can jump really high. Grasshoppers can jump really high.
But you don't always get to, or you may not think that you can.
You may not think that you can.
So maybe that, you know, you can coach the grasshopper that eventually the higher jumping is in its future.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Well, you know, I don't know if I should think about even the poem I was going to read.
Please
but I was
do.
Going to read Please. This. Does anyone know this poem, The Song to the Man of the People, about Charlie Chaplin? Well, there's a. It is translated. It was written by Carlos Drummond de Andrade, who's a Portuguese poet. And there's a part of it that says, "There are too few dinners in the world, as you well know. And the most inviting chickens are covered by glass domes over china platters. There is always glass, and it never breaks. There is steel, asbestos, the law, an entire militia protecting that chicken, and a hunger blowing all the way from Canada, a wind, a glacial voice, the breath of winter, a leaf, hovering indecisively, alights on your shoulder, an indistinct message that you can barely decipher. Between the chicken and hunger, there is unbreakable glass. Between the hand and hunger, the barriers of the law and infinite space. Then you transform into a great roast chicken, suspended in midair above all hungers, chicken of burnished gold and flame, a feast for all, on the day for all, but it is slow in coming. First of all, the idea of a chicken suspended in midair of burnished gold is probably the greatest thing I've ever experienced in my life. But I think that what Andrade does through the translator is to say, you know, what is the hunger that is blowing for all of us? You know, what does it mean in this case? Charlie Chaplin, who was an image of value, you know, and of meaning.
Well, he was
in a
certainly,
space where there
was certainly a trickster figure, being able to go inside and outside of things as well. And you know, how willing are we to pursue our own happiness independent of what the world tells us, and independent of the fears that we might have of not being able to truly belong in this country or any country ever?
Yeah.
You know, there's a saying in the Middle Ages. You guys still with me in the Middle Ages? Awesome. Yeah, right? The Jews of Poland would always have a packed suitcase underneath their bed. They go out to work and there'd always be a pack. This obviously is apropos of what we were talking about before. The good take on that is that maybe the Messiah will come and the world will end and they're going to take their stuff and go to, you know, what's next, and the promised idea of wonder and joy. That's great. And that's what we teach. And on one level, the other level is that you never know what's going to happen. And that stuff that you sew into your clothes and that which you always have at a moment's notice is just a fact of life. And okay, now what are you going to do about it? So how are you going to live amid the tears that we feel? And I think that is a moment that we can consider now as well, and become the chicken. That's what he's asking us to do.
For each of us.
For each of us, right? Yeah.
Shall we take a couple of questions, if there are any?
If we must.
If we must.
So what do y'all want to talk about? We heard some really interesting and challenging perspectives. What do y'all got?
Well, I'm just thinking about some music. Robert Johnson, Hellhound on My Trail. And Fats Waller's Why Am I So Black and Blue? And then James Brown, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. So how would you relate that progression? And obviously, every group has a similar progression.
Rose, I think that's right. And I think that's very much a part of the themes that we're pursuing here. And I think that idea of having music be a liberating force, being a force of pride, being a force of being able not only to serve the music, but to have it communicate what we want it to communicate, goes across all idioms and genres as well. And we're going to end with sort of a song of pushback, of retrograde to a degree. We're also going to end with a song of hope, where this kind of pride is taken in stride and is not because of the sharpness that one might feel based on one's everyday encounters. So I think that those are great additions to something that we're trying to think about right now. Thank you.
Yes, just kind of alluding back to the previous discussion you had with the band, and sometimes the song, as painful as it might be, was information, because the musician was an important part of the his story. You know, how did I know what was going on in a particular area without the minstrel, without the musician who was traveling from place to place that told the story in the song, that gave the news? You know, the gospel quartets who would go from the south up to the north and visit, and so the north would know basically what was going on. So I think that's an important part, that even though it was painful, the musicians, you know, had to tell the story, or the story wouldn't be shared or spread about, because they were our early form of social media and news and what have you.
God, that's such a good point.
That's right, and I thank you. And at least my tradition equates musicians as a form of prophecy as well. So I think that I love that comparison to social media, and you're right, as musicians would be itinerant and go from place to place. Exactly right. I think it helped people discover common mores and common ideas, as well as share news. And if you listen closely enough to it, that music is a form of prophecy.
But even we did the show on Leonard Bernstein, you know, and his Stein. Sorry, whatever. God, I always get that wrong. Anyway, we did this show on Leonard Bernstein. And the thing, and he wanted to be a musician. And his father was like, no. Because the idea of the musician to him was like this kind of traveling musician. You know?
There's a saying in Yiddish which translates as, when the musicians come to town, hide your daughters.
Next question.
Which is why I think...
That's the next question. But I think... I mean, it's interesting. It's an unsettling... It's more than just unsettling. Yeah, totally. It's destabilizing.
Sure. You guys, how many of your parents were so thrilled that you became musicians?
25 years at UT. They're...
Well, no, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, it's a very... what am I going to say? I mean, is it not... Red, I would love to... Is it not a...
It's always good when they didn't hear from me, because they knew when they heard from me, I'd need money.
No, it's one of the reasons I became who I am, because I can't deal with the unknown, the uncertainty of what tomorrow or the next month or the next week will bring. I just, that's a lot. That's a hard place to live, for me at least.
But art, I mean, also brings you back to the sensuality of being a human being, you know, the senses. And I think that, like, in a society where we benefit from not feeling things sometimes, then, you know, professions where that draw you back into your body and to yourself and to your connections, those are very destabilizing.
And it's so necessary. So thank you. That's a beautiful reminder of the necessity to feel, and having agents who help us and remind us of that fact and get us to a place of feeling physically, spiritually, and emotionally. Exactly. That's what a musician is and does. Not only serving the music, which I think is modest, it helps us recover our sense of humanness in its most important degree.
Woo! Another question? One last question?
So correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe earlier you remarked on music being political in nature. I was curious on your insights of how music historically has been political and how it compares to politics today, and how that is affecting and shaping music of, you know, the 1990s and early 2000s, and how we can interpret that and go forward with it.
No, I think that's right. I'm just going to look up something real quick, because I was talking about this with somebody else yesterday. Back in the day, I was studying the history of folk songs. And folk songs are certainly can be used in all variety of ways, whether for weddings or for anthems or for whatever. So I think that the richness that a song holds for a culture, for a cultural moment, for measuring something, definitely is used, and if that's what you're asking, I think that that is in play now too. I don't know, you know, if there's a particular genre over another, but I wasn't familiar with a song, but maybe you all know it. The song called "All Right" by Kendrick Lamar. So that is being used place by place. NPR did a story on it yesterday. I don't know if you all heard it, but this sense of resistance, we're going to be all right, is being used in public places of assembly. And in its own, it wasn't written for that. It wasn't written as a protest song, but it becomes a song where people can appreciate that no matter what the difficulty of the moment is, that people have a sense of looking forward. So I think that is in a very long history of, and I've written my own music. It's not for sale. Andre's music is for sale though, but which you should buy, all of it, and you should. But the idea is that I think the national anthems are really something that I've written about and thought about, as well as anthems that are sung during sporting events like football or soccer in Europe. And they have so much to say about the critique of what a culture is, depending on what one chooses to say as representing itself in a culture or in a country or in a space. And I think that it's a question that many, many people are asking or thinking about, is that what should be our national anthem? You know, what does it say about us when we sing or take me out to the ball game? Well, what does it reflect upon us as a culture? And I think that whether it's political or a sense of essentiality of what we hold and what we privilege is something that I think we can think more about.
And I think we're going to close out with a couple tunes. And I'm going to sign off right now and turn it over to you and say thank you all for coming out this evening to the Cactus Cafe.
Thanks, Rebecca McEnroy, everybody. An amazing jewel in this city. So we're going to end with a couple of tunes, and again, forgive the pose today, but it's just something that's, you know, getting it out here, so I don't have to deal with it, you know, during the day job, which is nice. So it's we're going to do two tunes. The first, again, in that spirit of pushing back or backlash, is a song called Love Me or Leave Me. Nobody? Okay, fine. Love Me or Leave Me, written way back in 1928. We're going to do a version that was recorded by Miles Davis on his compilation album called Walkin' in 1957. And the sense of protesting of what is and what isn't my country, wrong or right. And we're going to end with a really beautiful spiritual meditative piece. We're going to ask you to hum on your way out that reflects unknown distant possibilities. It was written by Lee Morgan in 1964 called Search for the New Land. And it was released in 1966. Lee Morgan himself had a really unfortunate end. He was killed on stage by a jealous girlfriend. But I don't want to leave that for you, with you, but I do want to tell you that. But Search for the New Land is an important aspect, I think, that we can do, even in this country, not to find the new Atlantis, but to find a way that we, all of us, can continue to soften our hearts and continue to have the difficult conversations without judgment, without exile, allowing us to consider what we mean by America and how we offer what is sacred to us in the world as we need to. So again, Love Me or Leave Me, and then search for the new land. And we're very, very fortunate to be together. We thank the wonderful folks of Cactus Cafe, KUTX, KUT, for a wonderful infrastructure and wonderful presentation, as we welcome back our wonderful musicians as well for these final two songs. Scott Lanningham on drums. John Fremgen on bass. Red Young on piano. Mike Malone on saxophone. Andre Hayward on trombone. Dr. Adrian Ruiz on trumpet. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Red Young on piano, ladies and gentlemen. John Fremigan on bass. Scott Langham killing it on drums. Adrian Ruiz, saxophone. Andre Hayward, get out of town with that. And Michael Malone, ladies and gentlemen. Rabbi. And Jazzy Sorrell, Neil Bruno. It's a pleasure. Have a beautiful night. Please come out for the next Views and Brews. Drive safe, and thank you for coming in.
You've been listening to A Views and Brews, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas, for KUT Radio. You'll find a complete archive of all of our Views and Brews in the iTunes store, or go to KUT.org for more information. Thanks for listening.